All right, we are back into our series, Would the Real God Please Stand Up, an examination of the book of Exodus. So why don't you open your Bibles there if you would. We're going to go into chapters 13 and 14, and while you're opening up your Bibles, your Bible app, whatever it is that you best use to track this narrative, do that. We've been studying it for a couple weeks now, this story of God when he rescued Israel from slavery in Egypt. God heard the cry of his people, and he took action, and not just on his own, but he partnered up with Moses and Aaron. God brought signs and wonders in support of Moses as a leader, as a testament of who he is, Yahweh, the one and only God, and as a judgment on the gods of Egypt, which is where we left off last week. He wave upon wave of plagues. God revealed himself, contested himself against the false gods of the Egyptian religious system, invited Pharaoh and all of Egypt to see these wonders, to see the truth, and then to turn to him. God repeatedly exposed the impotence of the Egyptian gods, up to and including Pharaoh's son, whom we've talked about as being the next in line God, because Pharaoh himself would have been considered a god, an iteration of one at least. God reserves the right to judge, even to take lives of firstborn Egyptian children and animals, even to take the life of a so-called Egyptian son of God. That's where we left off. Are we okay with letting God be judge? All right, let's go. Exodus chapter 13, verses 1 and 2. All right. Back with the glasses. Oh, boy. Okay. Good. The Lord said to Moses, consecrate to me every firstborn male, the first offspring of every womb among the Israelites belongs to me, whether man or animal. So to consecrate something means to set it aside as if belonging to God. In this case, it is to set aside firstborn males, man or animal. Why? Well, we'll get to that in a moment. But have you noticed a pattern yet in the Exodus narrative, at least to this point? Israel is God's firstborn son, so to speak. Pharaoh bitterly enslaved that firstborn son. And God rescued that firstborn son, not by taking the life of Pharaoh's firstborn son, but certainly that was the plague that convinced Pharaoh to let the people go. So, a firstborn son is enslaved. Then another firstborn's death was critical for their rescue. Does this sound like anything yet? As we mentioned in a previous teaching, the Hebrew people learned from the Passover that an innocent life would need to be sacrificed in their place for them to be spared from death. Do you see it? This is metaphor for our salvation. We are firstborn children enslaved by sin and its consequences. But Jesus, God's one and only Son, would offer, not take, his life to rescue us from death. Do you see it there? All right, let's keep going. Verses 3 through to 10, if you would follow along with me there. Then Moses said to the people, commemorate this day, the day you came out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery, because the Lord brought you out of it with a mighty hand. Eat nothing containing yeast. Today, in the month of Abib, you are leaving. When the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Hivites, and Jebusites, the land he swore to your forefathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, you are to observe this ceremony in this month. For 7 days, eat bread made without yeast, and on the seventh day, hold a festival to the Lord. Eat unleavened bread during those 7 days. Nothing with yeast in it is to be seen among you. That's pretty strict. Nor shall any yeast be seen anywhere within your borders. Wow. On that day, tell your son, I do this because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt. This observance will be for you like a sign on your hand and a reminder on your forehead that the law of the Lord is to be on your lips. So head to heart to lips. For the Lord brought you out of Egypt with his mighty hand. You must keep this ordinance at the appointed time year after year. So, as you can see, this is a text of instructions to Israel to annually remember their rescue from Egypt with a feast, which is a 7-day festival. It'll act as a sign, as I was saying, to their head and to their heart and to their lips. Today, literally the end of this month, the month of Abib, Jews prepare for Passover by removing all traces of, and here's the word, the slide is shametz, which is leaven, anything that causes anything to rise, from their homes. Leaven, like yeast, as you may know, produces fermentation, especially in bread dough. It's the result of natural processes of decay. Where's that going? Orthodox Jews, therefore, vacuum their homes, wipe down cupboards, and physically remove all breadstuffs from their houses as an act of penance to keep from decay, to be mindful of their sin, to think on that, but also as an act of obedience to the command to remove all leaven from their homes. This symbolic drama of purging decay from their homes is known as the Bedikat Shemetz. Unleavened bread also points to Jesus. Unleavened bread is pure and simple. Just add flour and water, mix, bake. Unleavened bread also has nothing added to it from outside of it that would corrupt it, like yeast. Unleavened bread, then, is a picture of the purity and the holiness of Jesus. You may remember years ago here at Crossroads, we had a Messianic Jewish friend of mine and Jackie's come and explain the Passover and how it pointed to Jesus Christ in many of its elements, even from the striping of the unleavened bread. You may remember that. I should tell you, actually, that that friend has passed away since because of cancer, probably a year ago now. So it's a real loss for us, but we miss her greatly. Joelle Chilcott was her name. And she pointed us even then to these things. Jesus' life and death were without decay. He was considered, and I'm quoting from 1 Peter, a lamb without spot or blemish, perfect for the ultimate Passover sacrifice. And after Jesus was buried, his body didn't decompose, didn't return to the dust, as was the curse with Adam and Eve. Oh, no, my friends. Jesus shed those grave clothes. He appeared to hundreds of people after he had risen from the dead, ate with, taught his disciples, walked with two of them on the road to Emmaus, appeared to the doubter, commissioned those who would follow him, and then ascended into heaven and took his rightful place at the right hand of his Father, at the right hand of our Father. Jesus killed the power of death dead. As the writer of Hebrews puts it, Christ appeared once for all to do away with sin, which leads to death by the sacrifice of himself, Jesus, who we've just finished singing about. The Feast of Unleavened Bread marked that Hebrews is a very unique people. Today, their ancestors reenact with their hands the drama of that hasty exit out of Egypt. The Bedikat Shemetz is a physical cue for a mental reminder in their heads, and the feast is a sign on their lips as they tell the story of their rescue to their children. So when it says, tell this story to your sons, that's just representative. Tell this to your family. Tell this to your sons, daughters, family altogether. What about us? What would mark us as followers of Jesus Christ? Are there things that we do with our hands? that remind us in our heads of our relationship with our God, that would cue us for things to talk about, which would be about him. Things that would reinforce our faith, things that would require an explanation to the children in our lives, things that would be visible by anybody who would see our lives. Christmas, Easter, baptism, communion, the way we raise our children, how we serve others, how we love one another. How about any decisions we make? Do they mark us as different than the culture? Let's continue in the narrative here, verses 11 through 16. After the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites and gives it to you, as he promised on oath to you and your forefathers, you are to give over to the Lord the first offspring of every womb. All the firstborn males of your livestock belong to the Lord. Redeem with a lamb every firstborn donkey, but if you do not redeem it, break its neck. Redeem every firstborn among your sons. In days to come, when your sons ask you, what does this mean? Say to them, with a mighty hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. When Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord killed every firstborn in Egypt, both man and animal. This is why I sacrifice to the Lord the first male offspring of every womb and redeem each of my firstborn sons. And it will be like a sign on your hand and a symbol on your forehead that the Lord brought us out of Egypt with his mighty hand. And redeem each of my firstborn sons. What does this and the consecration of the firstborns even mean? It stems from the Passover itself, okay? God spared the oldest son of every house marked with what? The blood on the door frames of those homes. During that night, the Israelites escaped from Egypt. God therefore had a rightful claim to those boys that he had saved. He had rescued them from death. So, God asked the Hebrews to set aside and sacrifice an animal, but set aside the eldest sons for his purposes as a way of redeeming them. That is to say, as a way of buying them back. So this symbolic act would have several purposes, I would think. One would be, it would act as a reminder to the people of how God had spared their sons from death and freed them all from slavery. So as often as they would do it, they'd remember, oh, this is why we do it. And I tell my kids, this is why we do it. Because of, oh, that day. It would act as a reminder to teach the children, right? To train a child, as the Proverbs would say later, in the way he should go. And then thirdly, it would act as a sign to come. The day when Jesus would buy us back from the dead by paying the price for our sin once and for all. Again, what we sung about this morning. All right. Verses 17 and 18 then. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God said if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. God then, therefore, led the people around by the desert road toward the Red Sea. The Israelites went up out of Egypt armed for battle. Never missing a detail. Even though they did go up out of Egypt armed as they were yet slaves, right? They weren't battle-trained or battle-tested people, men, women, children, perhaps ready, but probably not able. Whatever the case, God didn't take them along the short route from Egypt to the Promised Land. He took them by a longer route to avoid fighting with the Philistines. So no shortcuts. It would seem that God sometimes doesn't work in ways that might seem best to us as well. Like, aren't shortcuts always better, especially if the path between a bad thing like slavery And that between that and a good thing like freedom? And doesn't God just lead them into a dead end anyway? How is that the best plan? We may see this in our lives too, when God doesn't seem to lead us along the shortest paths to our goals. What will we do with this? Will we complain, as the Israelites will very shortly? Will we resist God? Will we grow impatient? Will we say, oh, clearly God's not really focused here. I'm going to move on my own. Or will we be patient? Will we watch to see what God is up to? Will we choose to still follow him and do our part even when we don't know why he's leading us the way he is or taking as long as he sometimes does? Will we trust that he can see the end of our journeys from their beginnings and that he knows the safest and best possible routes? Exodus chapter 13, verse 19, very quickly. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him because Joseph had made the sons of Israel swear an oath. He had said to them at that time, God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up with you from this place. So Moses was faithful to that. That was probably not a bad little piece of encouragement for Moses at that time, I suspect. Tucked away for such a time as this, Joseph's prophetic word that God will surely come to your aid. We're on the run. We've been delivered. He did. But what's coming? We're hemmed in. We'll talk more about that shortly. Maybe we could be similarly encouraged by what Jesus says in John chapter 16, verse 33. In this world, you will have trouble, but take heart. I have overcome the world. So per Corey's prayer, we all come, and this is true every Sunday morning, variously hurt, broken, wondering, angry, grieving, wounded, happy, comforted, hopeful, at peace, centered, enjoying Jesus. It's always that continuum. Always. But for those who are limping in this morning, wondering what, maybe you see in this story some encouragement that Joseph was able to give Moses, and I am now giving you from Jesus himself. What I love about Jesus, and I quote that verse often because it's operative for me, is there's no sham there. It's like, oh, you know, when you become a Christian, it's going to be golden. It's going to be really smooth and easy. Like, it's great stuff. It is great stuff. But he says what? He says, in this world, you will have trouble. It's no surprise, right? When we have trouble, we shouldn't go, oh, I did not see that coming. Yes, you did. Because Jesus said so. And we live in a world where there's all kinds of trouble. But the hope of hope is that we're not in it alone, that Jesus has overcome the world, and having him in our lives, Christ in us, is our ability to overcome anything that comes our way. Not that we're smarter, not that we're stronger, not that we're more emotionally resilient, none of these, but because Christ is in our lives. Exodus chapter 13, verses 12. Oh, close out the chapter here, it looks like. Yep. All right, verse 20. After leaving Succoth, they camped at Etham on the edge of the desert. By day, the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them. What? On their way, and by night, in a pillar of fire to give them light so that they could travel by day or night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people. Like, wouldn't that be so cool to have a pillar of fire or cloud to guide us day and night? Can you imagine, right? You're out for lunch with a bunch of friends who get there just before, you know, you do. They see you roll in and ask you once you're sitting down, hey, what was that pillar of cloud I saw in front of your car? Like leading the way. Or was that just a tightly configured exhaust fume from the car in front of you? Or more likely, in Chilliwack, a very localized cloud burst, regionally sending showers down. We know the word for these appearances, physical, visible forms to humanity of God, are called theophanies. And there's a number of them in the scriptures. Oh, Like what it must have done for Israel to know that the lead edge was this light in the darkness, this light through the day to lead them. God gave Israel a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire to know that day and night God was with them on their journey to the promised land. What about us? It's rhetorical, and you'll answer this question for yourself. What has God given us to guide us all the days of our lives? I always go back to this right here, quite frankly, because I'm emotional, and I understand that. And I need objective black and white sometimes to get me back on the rails. This is what he's given us to begin with. This is the most complete revelation of who Christ is. It's right there. It's for us to choose to believe it or not. So there's at least that, the word of God itself. He's given us also an intuitive sense of the truth by placing his spirit, his truth-telling, his truth-revealing spirit in us, who will, as the scripture says in Matthew and other gospels for that matter, guide us into all that is true. We would do well to listen to this inner voice, but we'd also do well to clarify this inner voice with a community of people that are also following Jesus Christ. So there's the third thing he has given us. He's given us the church, each other, with all of our foibles, all broken, all evenly cared for and loved at the foot of the cross. But we have a chance to encourage each other and clarify and make sure that we aren't way off base. Oh, I think it'd be okay to do this. Or not. Is our chance to speak into people's lives. Or, yes, that's the truth. That's going to bring life. That won't. All right. That's Exodus chapter 13. Let's move into chapter 14, verses 1 through 4. Then the Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp near... Oh, boy. What's with these names? You're killing me. Yeah. Anyway, the pie thing there. Between Migdol and the sea, they are to encamp by the sea directly opposite Baal Zephon. Pharaoh will think the Israelites are wandering around the land in confusion, hemmed in by the desert. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them. But I will gain glory for myself through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. So the Israelites did this. And back to our rhetorical questions of earlier. Doesn't God just lead them into a dead end anyway? And how is that a better plan? Here we have our answers, right? Yes, God did lead Israel into what seemed like a dead end, pun intended. They were hemmed in by the desert and the mountains and the sea, but why? Well, the answer is right there, does God, so that God would gain his rightful glory and so that the Egyptians would know definitively, if they didn't know yet, and many had responded, which we talked about earlier, even previously with the other plagues, progressively, and many of those Egyptians left with the Hebrews as they exited, as they exodused. But this is another attempt, but there's no turning back on this one. And as we'll see later, the other reasons might include to increase Israel's trust in God and Moses, which is going to come in pretty handy for the next 40 years or so as they wander the desert. And how would God bring such glory to himself? How would he do that? Well, the text is clear again there as well. By hardening Pharaoh's heart so that his army would pursue the Israelites to the Red Sea, where God would vanquish them. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. Let's carry on, though, in verses 5 through 9. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, which right there you should stop and say, wait a second. Didn't he say they could go? Like, why is this all of a sudden needing to be reported to him? Can you imagine Pharaoh saying, I did not know that. Did those little rascals already leave? I just did not know that. Maybe it's just me. Okay. What verse are we in? Okay. Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds about them and said, what have we done? We have let the Israelites go and have lost their services. Oh, my. So he had his chariot made ready and took his army with him. He took 600 of the best chariots along with all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So that's twice now we've seen that. Hardening of the heart God did to Pharaoh. We'll talk about that momentarily. So that he pursued the Israelites, who were marching out boldly. The Egyptians, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots, horsemen and troops, pursued the Israelites and overtook them as they camped by the sea near Pi, opposite Baal Zeb. There we go. I'm going to shorten those things up from now on, save time. Can you imagine, right? If you're the Israelites, okay, we just got miraculously moved out. We were rescued, and okay, we're locked in now, and they're descending, and we're going to get wiped out, completely removed from the planet. 600 Egyptian war chariots were bearing down on these slaves, untrained, untested Israelites. Not ready for battle. And when we say 600 chariots, what we mean is 1,200 trained warriors, because there would be one trained warrior driving while the other one was doing the killing. This is that version of tank for that age, right? Driver, killer. That was it. 1,200 of them. Pharaoh needed, after all, to retrieve his cheap labor force. So that's why he's at work. That's the motivation. Moving to verses 5 through 9. Oh, hold on here. No, that was 5 through 9. Let's try 10 to... I'm feeling like 12. 12, is that good for you? Excellent. As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up. And there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. Good. Then they said to Moses, so a very brief prayer meeting. Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert? No, they never said that, actually, to be quite honest. They never did say such a thing. But under pressure, with the Egyptian army sweeping in for the kill, happy rider, killing machine on the right, the Israelites began to complain and to romanticize about their past, didn't they? Had they already forgotten the Passover? Like, the Passover. How much more could God do that would convince the Israelites that he was in their corner? Never mind convincing the Egyptians. This passage reminds me that I am of the same lot as Israel, that I too forget too quickly what God has done for me, that if I remembered such things, I would likely romanticize less about the past, persevere in the present, and not spend so much time fantasizing about the future and what is yet to come. That's crazy, Israelites. Okay. Let's go. Verses 13 and 14. Moses answered the people. Are you kidding me? You never said that. No, he didn't say that. Do not be afraid. Stand firm. So that's what I would say if I was a leader. Are you kidding me? You never said that. Eager to justify myself. No. In fact, I have an email right here. Did not say that. But not Moses. Don't be afraid. Stand firm and what? You will see the deliverance Lord will bring you today. Ah, like the Passover. The Egyptians you see today, you're never going to see them again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only be still. I like that one. Moses, what a good leader, right? Of all the things we remember him for, he doesn't make it to the promised land. He smotes the rock when he should have just spoke to it. Like, we tend to forget that he was a phenomenal leader. He has repeatedly turned to God to follow him so that he could lead others. And here he expressed the faith that the people lacked and they desperately needed, actually. He gave them hope because he had his eyes where? Not on the Egyptians descending as they're hemmed in. And my goodness, that's a very handsome tank they have there. No, no, no. He had his eyes focused on the one who had saved them already and would not just save them, to kill them. The Lord will fight for you. You need only be still. Like, that is a supremely good line, particularly for any of us who might feel trapped in whatever situations we may find ourselves. Verses 15 and 18, through 18. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Why are you crying out to me?" Okay, isn't that a good thing, God? "Tell the Israelites to move on. Raise your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea to divide the water so that the Israelites can go through the sea on dry ground," which I'm sure Moses is saying, "I did not see that coming. I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them, and I will gain glory through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I gain glory through Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen." Again, as we said before, this sounds like God is an egomaniac, right? I need the glory, I need the glory, I need the glory, I need the glory, I need the glory. But here's the truth. When there's nothing else in the universe that deserves the glory that is only God's, now that's not egoism, that's just flat out truth. And that is what God wants us all to see. Not just the Egyptians, not just the Israelites, not just the Jews, not just the Gentiles, all of us. So which is it? You need to only be still, verse 14, or move on, verse 15. I mean, still, cry out. Which is it? The Lord told Moses, effectively, to stop praying and get moving, which to my mind seems to suggest that there is a time to pray, but there's also a time to act, right? I wonder if sometimes we know what to do, but we pray for more guidance or clarity or for a door to open or something like this, and use this as an excuse for postponing what we know we should do. Which, by the way, when you say it that way, "I am praying about it," if anyone tries to speak into that and challenge that because it's cloaked in religious jargon, it's very hard to challenge, isn't it? "I'm praying about it." Good. Excellent. Pray, read the word, discern, but act. Move. Not to put too fine a point on this, but if we know what we should do because we've read the word, clarified it there with our thinking, we have been praying about it, and we have discerned it in community, then it's time to get moving, people. This is the third time now in this narrative, in chapter 14 specifically, where it is recorded that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. So you see it in verse 4, you see it in verse 8, and now in verse 17. Because, we're going to talk about this again, because I think it's a stumbling block for so many people that would ask questions like, how can God hold Pharaoh responsible for not responding to God, him, if God himself hardens Pharaoh's heart to responding to him? It's worth a pretty quick review of what we said last time. So last time, this is what we said. Pharaoh's heart is hardened roughly how many times? Do you remember how many times? Please, please give it to me. Anybody? Take a shot. Okay, A, 5. B, 10. C, 15. D, 20. What? 10. Okay. Anybody else? 20 times. Okay. The scriptures roughly 20 times. So hardened Pharaoh's heart and his officials. Right? So there's 20 times where Pharaoh's heart is hardened. 10 of those, Pharaoh hardened his own heart. 10 of those, psych, 10 of those are God hardening his heart. Now, what's really important is to recognize the order of those and how they happen. Pharaoh hardens his heart first, those 10 times. And then what seems to happen is God partners with and solidifies Pharaoh's choices in the end. This seems to be how God judged Pharaoh, which is actually parallel to what we read in Romans chapter 1 about God's wrath in this age, not the judgment in the end, but in this age. This is how it's worked out, by giving people over to the consequences of their choices, which is what God did with Pharaoh, but solidified that to bring glory, to reveal who he is, to judge the gods of Egypt, and to give Egypt a chance to say, oh, I see it, I see it. Our gods can't do what that God is doing. All right. Verses 19 and 20. There we go. Then the angel of God, who had been traveling in front of Israel's army, withdrew and went behind them. The pillar of cloud also moved from in front and stood behind them, coming between the armies of Egypt and Israel. Nice. Get the rear guard there. Throughout the night, the cloud brought darkness to the one side and light to the other side, so neither went near the other all night long. What a plan. That's brilliant. Love that stuff. All right. And so God began to do the work that he would do, that he said, the Lord will fight for you. You will need to only be still. This is the first evidence of it. We'll continue to read in verses 21 to 31. See what it looks like. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. The waters were divided, and the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and on their left. The Egyptians pursued them, and all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and horsemen followed them into the sea. During the last watch of the night, the Lord looked down from the pillar of fire and cloud at the Egyptian army and threw it into confusion. He made the wheels of their chariots come off so that they had difficulty driving. And the Egyptians said, let's book it. The Lord is fighting for them against us. Then the Lord said, I'm paraphrasing. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may flow back over the Egyptians and their chariots and horsemen. Moses did so. And at daybreak, the sea went back to its place. The Egyptians were fleeing toward it, and the Lord swept them into the sea. The water flowed back and covered the chariots and horsemen, the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea. Not one of them survived. Indeed, they would not see these men ever again. But the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and on their left. That day, the Lord saved Israel from the hands of the Egyptians again. And Israel saw the Egyptians lying dead on the shore. Notice verse 31. And when the Israelites saw the great power of the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people what? Feared. Their jaws dropped. What kind of God is this? My God, our God, wow. And put their trust in that God, in our God, and in Moses, his servant. All right. Did you see the proportion of activity between what God did and what Moses did? God's action began with giving Israel a rear guard, as I spoke about earlier, to protect them from the Egyptian army and confuse them a bit in that even. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. Sure. But was that really necessary? Do we think that God couldn't have accomplished what he did without Moses stretching out his hand a couple of times? We'll see this again in chapter 15 when we get there next week, when God sweetened the bitter drinking water at Mara by getting Moses to throw a piece of wood into the stream. Why would God do this? Why would he include Moses in what he was doing, even when God could certainly do it on his own? And then, why does he include us in what he's up to? Well, it's not because he can't do it, not someone who is all-powerful. And it's not because he's too busy, not someone who made time and then therefore lives outside of it. And it's not because he doesn't care, because we know God is love. Indeed, I suspect that God involved Moses and involves us in his plans because he is that relational. To borrow an example from Pastor Greg's life, which I didn't ask permission for, so we'll just keep it secret here. Corey, especially you. He'd be okay with this, actually. He is excavating, Greg is, a part of his basement for our renovation for a suite, basically, in the bottom of their home. He could do it on his own, or he could involve those whom he calls the littles, the three we adopted ones. He could get the job done better and quicker on his own, but because he is so relational, he chooses to involve his kids, the ones he loves, who he not coincidentally calls his minions. So God didn't need Moses to stretch out his hand, but he involved him in his plans because he just loves Moses. God doesn't need us to do whatever, but he invites us to partner with him because he loves doing things with his kids. You'll even notice that the text says, not Moses, but the Lord drove back the sea, right? The Lord will fight for you. You need only be still. Then the Lord threw the Egyptians into confusion and made the wheels of their chariots come off such that they exclaimed, as I did sort of earlier, let's get out of here, and confessed, which is to say, there is an agreement. This is the truth. The truth is that their God is fighting against us, and they're so winning. Then the Lord, with Moses as his partner, swept the Egyptians into the sea. No one would survive. The Lord will fight for you. You need only be still. The Lord saved Israel from the hands of the Egyptians, and so they placed their trust in him evermore, and even still more in his partner Moses. All right, that, as they say, was the text. Here are our takeaways for this morning. The first one is, who is responsible to teach our children about God? That was a very timely cry back there. Thank you, Brittany. Could you maybe produce that on cue next time as well? In short, the answer to that question is we all are, right? But the main responsibility from this text, certainly, and other texts previously in Exodus, falls to who, do you think? You, the family, right? God gave the job of passing along the meaning of the Passover to the church. Ooh, to the parents, not institutions, not even primarily the church. Yes, we, the church, will and we should come alongside parents to disciple their children. It's why, for instance, we have a kids' zone on Sunday mornings. And we are grateful for our kids' zone teachers who give of their time and their talent and their giftedness to teach our kids, to partner with our parents, to train our children in the way that they ought to go. And yet the Bible puts the onus on family, dads, moms, aunts, uncles, to pass along, grandparents, the teachings and stories of our faith. As Moses would later write in Deuteronomy chapter 6 and 11, sort of same text, fix these words of mine, so these are the words of God, the law in this case, in your hearts and minds, teach them to your children, talking about them when you sit at home, and when you walk along the road, when you lie down, and when you get up. These verses support long-time family faith traditions like mealtime devotions and prayers while sitting together. like bedtime Bible stories and prayers when they lie down at night, and like morning prayers when they awake. But it isn't limited to this either, right? Teach them when you walk along the road. In other words, teach them wherever you are doing life with them. When our kids ask us questions, wherever they ask us those questions, and they will, and you, boy, I hope they do, right? You want them to. Let's pause and think and take time to answer thoughtfully. And if we don't know the answer, let's, find one with them. It'll teach us as we disciple them. So you may be saying, wow, I don't have any kids. That's good. I'm off the hook. Yeah, not so fast, mister. As I began to answer this question, we can all have a part if there are any children in our lives. Second takeaway is, where do we live? Do we live in the past, the present, or do we live in the future? When Israel was cornered by the Egyptian army, they complained and they romanticized about their past. They said, it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert, because those slave labor days where their brothers dropped like flies from the inhuman demands of their work, those days were so good. Not really. It's tempting to romanticize the past and fantasize about the future when times are tough. And yet, times weren't necessarily better in the past, right? And who knows what the future is going to bring. Even the writer of Ecclesiastes warns, and this is in Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 10. Memorize this. This is golden. Do not say, says the writer of Ecclesiastes, why were the old days better than these? Why were the old days better than these? Right? For it is not wise to ask such questions, which is a great verse, by the way, to use as a defense against older saints who ask this very question. So I used it a lot in Ontario because it was a much older church there. Why isn't it wise to ask this question? Well, maybe because, as we've said, the past wasn't so great, not nearly as great as we romanticize it to think it is or was. And maybe because living in the past, or the future for that matter, keeps us from fully engaging where? Right here, right now. Are we fully invested in the present? What are we learning? Are we paying attention? I've had a stretch of days recently that caused me to romanticize the past a fair amount and fantasize about the future. It's been day after day of personal confrontation that has quite simply eroded my self-confidence and well-being. It was very hard to stay in the present. But it was there in the present that I'd had chances to learn things that I needed to learn, to become a better leader and to become a better partner, quite frankly. You see, I could have justified myself and judge these others as having their own fair share of annoying little foibles. So don't bring me your crap. But in all cases, they spoke the truth to me. It was just really hard to hear it. It was effortful and it was draining work to absorb their criticisms with humility. To thank these folks for being brave enough to tell me and to commit myself to doing better. I could have comforted myself, oh, things were just so good back in Guelph. Which would have been partly true, but it would also have been partly not true. Things were good and things were bad in Guelph. But that kind of reminiscing would have kept me from learning what I needed to learn right now. In fact, that kind of looking back could have made me even more critical of the truth that I was hearing, such that I would just dismiss it entirely. Because I'd be so preoccupied in the past that I wasn't present in the future. And yet, how can we become more and more like Jesus Christ in the future if we don't learn what we can in the present? Don't look back. Just move forward. Those are the takeaways. Here are a couple questions that we can give some reflections to as our worship team comes forward. Here's the one. Sure. Am I missing any opportunities to teach children the most important things? Whatever children are in our lives, am I missing opportunities? Not made to make you feel guilty, but to trigger you to, okay, there now, thank you for putting that there, Father. I'll look for it now, right? And the second one is, where am I currently failing? This is a question I'd ask myself, to invest in the present, in my marriage or dating life, as a sibling, in my friendships, as a son or daughter, at work, like where is it that I'm not investing? So, worship team, would you come forward this time and perhaps maybe play a little something ambient and quiet and reflective, like not like a quiz song or anything like that, but you know, just something. Yeah, I think that'd be good. Not Jeopardy. That's what I was thinking. No, not that. So we'll give you some time just to think through, and maybe, Jocelyn, if you wouldn't mind just flipping from one question to the other, and this is your, because we're a church that tears down so quickly, right, this is a chance just to reflect and think on these things and invite the Spirit of God to challenge you, to encourage you. So you may even take the first question and say, the Lord, I didn't miss an opportunity recently. Thank you for being with me in that. And just being with kids and teaching them about you. Might be that, right? And then the second question is, Jocelyn again? There you go. So I'll stop talking. Take your time.